From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, James Van Praagh joins us, Unfinished Business, What the Dead Can Teach Us About Life. Well, the next time you go through an airport, one of those airports that has the ability to look right through you, listen to this story. Privacy advocates plan to call on the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to suspend, stop the use of the whole body imaging, the airport security technology that some critics say performs a virtual strip search and produces naked pictures of you. The national campaign, which will gather signatures from organizations and relevant professionals, is set to launch this week with the hope that it will go viral, according to Lily Cooney, the associate director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, which plans to lead the charge. They just want these machines gone. A moderate earthquake jolted Southern California, felt by millions, and sent at least one person to a hospital. But the region avoided significant damage and major injuries. I can't believe I dodged another earthquake coming here to St. Louis. The magnitude 4.7 quake hit at 8:39 p.m. Sunday night, centered about 10 miles southwest of downtown Los Angeles, 3 miles east of L.A. International Airport. At least 10 aftershocks had followed by early Monday, with the largest registering magnitude 3.1. The quake rattled the greater L.A. region for about 10 to 15 seconds, was felt as far south as San Diego. Cal Ori, author, intuitive, predicts earthquakes. Most recently, Cal predicted the 4.7 moderate Los Angeles quake. Cal, tell me, how'd you do it?
How did I do it? This one, you know, I live in Tahoe, so I'm 400 plus miles away, so I couldn't count on my animals to help me or any ear tones or anxiety. This was based, we had a 4 shock. We had a 4.4 that hit 60 miles from Long Beach and on May 1st, and I sensed that was a 4 shock. Long Beach is known to have, it's known for its 1933 March 11th quake, and I'm thinking that this could, we could see a replay of that. Not definitely, but it's been on my mind. And so with something with this distance, I keep getting nagging, a gut instinct, nagging word images, visions of the red square on the USGS map, that type of thing that intuitives can get, the messages and the nagging thoughts that it's just not going away, San Fernando Valley. And on my website, Earthquake Epicenter, on May 2nd, I said 4.5 to 4.9 plus Southern California, Long Beach, Simi Valley, Northridge, within a 60-mile radius would be the likely epicenters. Now, that was May 2nd to June 30th, probability 60%. So it was really an adrenaline rush to see that big red square last night, right where I said it was very close to Long Beach, within 16 miles, and the intensity in Long Beach was like 5. So it was the strongest felt in Long Beach, and some windows blew out. Yeah, so that really, I mean, wow. I mean, I couldn't believe it because I'm not even down there that this came true. I mean, I've predicted lots of quakes before, but I'm really a Northern California girl, and I get those. They're a lot easier. So,
well, the big question too, Cal, now is when will the big one hit?
Okay, I've done this on other radio shows when they ask that. I'm going with Nostradamus, and he says 2010. He mentions a great theater, and in May, Taurus. And I'm thinking Hollywood. I'm thinking a 7.0. A great quake is 8.0 plus. So I'm saying 2010 for a great quake. A major quake, now that's just a 7.0, well, just, but it's a 7.0 to a 7.9, like the Loma Prieta, the World Series quake. Right now I'm thinking it's a possibility it could happen from now until June 30th. I mean, Southern California is coming alive. Everybody knows that. We had the 5.4 last summer. I believe all the rain they had, the heat, that plays a part in it. In June 2005, Southern California, Northern California, we got June jitters. We had 4 significant quakes. I'm still putting my money on Northern California offshore. I have a wager with geologist Jim Berkland. He says Southern California still. I say Northern California. So I still believe Northern California, but it can play ping pong again like it did before.
All right. Well, you two are pretty accurate, Cal, and that's the scary part of all of this. Cal wrote a book, by the way, about Jim Berkland, the man who predicts earthquakes. Jim Berkland, maverick geologist. And they are uncanny when it comes to predicting. I mean, absolutely uncanny. The chief of the World Health Organization says she is not raising the world swine flu alert level just yet. Several countries, including Britain, Japan, and China, had urged the UN Health Agency to change how it decides to raise the alert level. WHO Chief Dr. Margaret Chan says the swine flu epidemic is a grace period now, with the WHO alert remaining at phase 5 out of a possible 6 for the last month. She told the WHO annual assembly on Monday that no one can say how long this period will last. She said the danger now is that the swine flu virus could mix with other flu strains and become more dangerous. Well, isn't that what they told us from the get-go? Keeping the brain active by working later in life may be an effective way to ward off Alzheimer's disease, according to research. Researchers analyzed data from 1,320 patients, including 382 men. They found that for the men, continuing to work late in life helped keep the brain sharp enough to delay dementia taking hold. Senator Robert Byrd, 91 years old, the longest surviving senator in history, hospitalized with a temperature spike, evidently caused by a minor infection. Byrd, a West Virginia Democrat, is being treated with antibiotics, responding well, and is expected to be released from the hospital in a few days. Byrd has been in Congress since 1952, first elected to the Senate 6 years later. And we got quite a scare yesterday. My father, 86 years old, was rushed to the hospital in Detroit. He is there now recovering. They are just trying to battle a lot of ailments that come along with an 86-year-old, so do say a prayer for him as well. After 5 amazing days, spacewalking astronauts finished repair work on the Hubble Space Telescope and shut the doors to the treasured observatory, which will be never touched by human hands again. NASA said the revived telescope will be better than ever, thanks to the astronauts' efforts, and should provide even more dazzling views of the universe for another 5 to 10 years. I just can't wait to see all those pictures. A teenager tried to rob an internet cafe with a banana, then ate the weapon before he was arrested. Police say he entered the shop in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, with the banana concealed under his T-shirt and demanded money. Well, the shop's owner and customers overcame the thief, called for help, but the teenager ate his banana before police arrived. They'll charge him with something, but having a concealed weapon won't be that. Da Vinci Code sequel Angels and Demons has soared to the top of the U.S. and Canada box office chart, taking in $48 million in the first weekend. Its takings between Friday and Sunday put Ron Howard's thriller well ahead of Star Trek, last week's number one film. In a moment, we're going to talk about the incredible concept of exoconsciousness with Rebecca Hardcastle. That story is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell said, "Exoconsciousness is an intriguing read on the frontiers of what is known, suspected, and theorized in the modern period of trying to better understand the cosmos and how it relates to us." Dr. Rebecca Hardcastle is a pioneer in paranormal research. She's affiliated with Quantric, a not-for-profit founded by Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell, combining science and spirituality in quantum physics. Dr. Hardcastle advocates for psychiatric acceptance of the paranormal experience as normal, including extraterrestrial contact, and her work encompasses research and validating psychic intelligence, experience, and abilities. Here's Dr. Rebecca Hardcastle on Coast to Coast. Rebecca, how are you?
Fine, George. It's lovely to be here tonight with you and your listeners.
My pleasure. Explain exoconsciousness to me.
Exoconsciousness is a concept that I created in 2004, so by now it's about 5 years old, so it's out of preschool, ready to mainstream into the world. And it takes about that long, I think, to really come up with a concept and develop it and run it through different phases of experience. And back in 2004, I remember it so distinctly. I was lying in bed, and I had been going through a phase where I've been a contactee for many years of my life. And that morning, I was lying in bed, and all of a sudden, the phrase exoconsciousness came in my mind, along with the definition of it. And the definition of it is that exoconsciousness is the extraterrestrial origins, dimensions, and abilities of human consciousness.
And it seems to be abound. It seems to be all over the place now, isn't it?
It is. At Stephen Bass's X Conference, the X Conference ended on what I would consider an up note by the whole, by Stephen himself, Stephen Bassett himself combining exopolitics with exoconsciousness. I've actually been affiliated with the exopolitical movement for many, many years, probably since about 2005. But it's just recently begun to be in the whole genre of speech around ufology and exopolitics.
Dr. Hardcastle, PhD, tell us a little bit about this personal history of your contact. Let's set the stage for that.
I've been a contactee since I was around 3 years old. And interestingly enough, I was just sitting here thinking whether or not you would ask me that question, and I was recalling back to what Stephen Bassett likes to talk about, the fact that he was told at a Washington dinner party one night that, Stephen, do you know where the center of UFO activity is in America? And of course, Stephen said no, or knowing Stephen, he probably guessed a few places. And the questioner looked at him and said, oh, it's West Virginia. And ironically enough, that's where I was born. That's where my contact started, was West Virginia. And I actually lived in a small town called Clarksburg, West Virginia, which is the place where Gray Barker worked, the man who coined the phrase Men in Black and was
yeah.
one of the first persons to write about UFOs in the popular mainstream magazines and newspapers.
Now, if this happened at three, was your family aware of all this?
We've never really talked about it, and I just wanted to send healing wishes to your father. You're so welcome. Both of my parents are deceased, and when I was becoming more visible in this field, I brought just psychic phenomenon up to my parents, and they were a little wary about it. My father was a minister in the United Methodist Church. So he had always been extremely liberal, but on this field, you know, as he got older, he was a little, he backed up from it somewhat. But I remember distinctly that from three on until I was approximately 11 or 12 years old, which I have to tell your listeners, this is such a common phenomenon, that a child will enter into psychic abilities and extraterrestrial contact around 3 or 4, and then around 11 and 12, it tapers off. That's when you move more into the world, 6th grade, 7th mm-hmm. grade, you figure out what's acceptable, what's not. And I remember at that point waking up with these just frightening people in my room that I, up until then, was fine with, and then at that point decided, no, I don't want any more of this. I want no part of this. I shut it down until I was in my early adulthood. But I remained psychic through this, but I switched off the ET. And I wonder whether or not that was orchestrated somewhat in my consciousness also.
Are young children who claim to see things, are they seeing ETs? And is it that ET contact that they might be talking about?
I believe it is, as I do hypnotherapy, and most young children are in a trance state most of the time. 3-4-year-old children, they're in almost a constant trance state of altered states of consciousness.
What do they want, Rebecca? What is going on? Why is this happening?
I don't think it's happened all of a sudden. I am thoroughly convinced that it's been an ongoing process with the human race, and some cultures have been more accepting of it than others, i.e., you know, certainly the Celtic culture or Hinduism, for example, or that the indigenous cultures, they've always been very accepting of extraterrestrial contact or star people contact or underworld contact from other dimensions. It's just our Western culture that has really backed away from it and not permitted it, kind of like what literary people refer to as an under the staircase kind of story. I always like that allusion. We can tell these stories under the staircase, but don't tell anywhere else.
One of the things that kept coming up with some people I was talking to at the X conference was the battle between this being a physical situation where people are actually being physically abducted out of their homes,
yes,
lifted up into craft, and then put back down, or it's merely all dimensional, almost psychic. And I don't know, where do you stand on that?
I'm a firm believer that where the mind goes, the body follows.
Okay.
So I would say that it is the entire spectrum. I think for some people, I think every contact experience is to a large extent consciousness. That's why when I got into this field professionally, I taught at a community college, and I taught ufology at the community college.
That's a great curriculum. How'd you get that in there?
Well, I just submitted a proposal. I wrote a course proposal, and I kept it very professional. And it went in through the continuing education. And that was back in 2005 at Scottsdale Community College. I called it extraterrestrial reality.
Rebecca, are people still laughing at contactees? You know, in the old days, the George Adamski days, you know, when he would say he was a contactee, a lot of people laughed at him. They really did. Are they still laughing today?
I believe that people aren't laughing today, but I see people hungering for it and asking, oh, I would love to have a sighting, or, oh, I would love to have contact, or my heart was so warm when at the X conference, people lined up to ask questions of the activist panel, and at least three or four people asked, how do I get exoconsciousness?
Well, that's good. And I noticed, too, the Wall Street Journal picks up on it now, the New York Times. It seems to be growing. You are picking up trying to follow through the legacy of John Mack, aren't
yes.
you?
Yes. John Mack is my legacy.
Well, you're doing yeoman's work, as we say in the Navy, and more people need to do this. I know John Carpenter in Missouri used to do a lot of this. He's not doing it hardly as much as he used to. If at all. And of course, John Mack, I think getting ridiculed in his profession as a psychiatrist, and now, you know, you're stepping forward too. The circles that you're in, how do they look at you? How do they react to you?
I had a very interesting time. It's been about 2 years now. I spoke at the American Philosophical Association in Baltimore, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke at the Carl Jaspers, who was a Swiss philosopher. I have a philosophical theology background. And I spoke on, they invited me to speak, and I spoke on exoconsciousness as psychopathology. And the audience was psychiatrists and university professors. And quite frankly, George, I was stunned at the lack of vocabulary or exposure to most of the concepts I was talking about.
Really?
Yes. And I left there, I left that conference and thought, we have so much work to do.
I would think that they would have, some of them would have embraced you, but I guess they're just not ready yet.
Oh, I want to qualify that. They did embrace me.
Okay.
And they were highly interested in it, but they didn't have the foundational, they hadn't read the foundational books. For example, they hadn't read Richard Dolan. They didn't know what remote viewing was. They were familiar with shamanistic terms, like a Grant Hancock,
sure,
would then something that would be acceptable to them. But much of the consciousness-based research that's gone on in terms of the military and the government and experimentations that we've had, they were unaware of that, as well as unaware of sightings and the whole massive amount of literature available.
Well, Backpack, many people claim that when they communicate with ETs, it's done telepathically. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Being telepathic is a must in exoconsciousness.
All right. Stay with us. The book, Exoconsciousness, with Dr. Rebecca Hardcastle. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment. Perhaps you might want to share your abduction story with us. That's next. We're going to take your phone calls with Dr. Rebecca Hardcastle, author of Exoconsciousness. And next hour, world-renowned medium James Van Praagh joins us with an incredible evening right here on Coast to Coast AM. Around L.A., we call him the Ambassador. His name's Tim, 43 years old on Tuesday. Tim, you're one of a kind, my friend. Happy birthday. Many, many more. Do you still communicate with them, Rebecca? Does it still happen?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it has become much clearer, much more mature, and it's a give and take at this point. There's a parity.
Are you glad this has happened to you? I mean, has this benefited your life?
Oh, there are immense benefits of exoconsciousness, and that's one of the things that I talk about in the book, is just the physical benefits alone of exoconsciousness. If we are going to, as your ads talked about, go to Mars, we are becoming a space-faring race. And exoconsciousness, as I said, where the mind goes, the body follows. Our bodies have to change if we are to become a space-faring civilization.
Throughout this planet, and specifically the United States, are there regions that are more hotbeds for alien abduction cases? I mean, I've got some friends in Hawaii, for example. That seems to be a huge area. What about other areas?
I think certainly I live in Phoenix now, and that's certainly an area where there's quite a few sightings, quite a bit of experience. I don't usually use the word abduction anymore. I call it more contact.
Okay.
You brought up John Mack earlier, and one of the things that John Mack is known for was a concept that he called fencing the fear. He talked about how do we move from contact being such a trauma-based experience into becoming transformational. And one of the things that I found out as John's legacy is that in the 21st century, because of the whole computer technology interface with consciousness, we now have the ability not just to fence the fear like John talked about, because in John's time, just talk therapy was what was available. Today, we can actually, with technology, go in and rewire neural pathways, so that those trauma scars that are actually in our brains, when we're traumatized or something frightens us, it makes a scar in our brains, and we can actually rewire that pathway. When people talk about being stuck in their lives, that's usually what's happened. They're running up against that neural scar. And there's a lot of trauma in contact because it's not yet a completely mainstream culture community experience.
Rebecca, but why the shroud of secrecy? Why does it seem like this has to be cloak and dagger in the middle of the night or when people are sleeping or not aware? I mean, it just isn't that obvious.
I think a lot of contact happens during the day. I think people talk to me about experiences that actually happen during the day and their normal lives. I had a client the other day that came in to see me, and when I opened the door and looked at her, I said, I said, oh my goodness, this woman is an ET. I mean, she looked like an ET.
What does an ET look like?
She had that extraterrestrial intelligence frequency about her. And so she came in and started talking about everything else but that. And at one point, I had to say it. So being kind of blunt, I just said to her, I said, you have a lot of ET frequencies. And she goes, oh, I don't believe in that. And so then we just went on with the session or whatever. At one point, she stops the session and looks at me and she goes, well, maybe I do. By the way, my mother was a Mormon, and she used to tell me that when I was first in the womb, when I was just a fetus, that there was something wrong with me, and the ETs came and said they were going to fix me, and the doctor wanted to abort me, and my mother said, no, I was going to be just fine, and the doctor kept saying, no, the tests are all wrong. She has to be aborted. My mother refused. The ETs came every night and worked with me. And she goes, look at me today. I was fine. My birth was fine.
That's amazing. Let's take some calls. West of the Rockies, Karen in Plummer, Idaho, you're up with us. Hello, Karen.
Hello, George. I was on your show back in 2003, and I told you about my experience in the mountains of northern Idaho.
And that was a long time ago, Karen. How are you?
Oh, I am so much better. I have almost healed, I'd say 95%, from I had the brain aneurysm afterwards. And I know it was connected to that, but, well, I had something. The doctors told me a year later that they don't think now that I had a brain aneurysm, but they don't know what the heck it was. But I almost died.
Well, I'm glad you're here and kicking.
But anyways, what I wanted to tell you about is it has enhanced my musical abilities so much for writing. And my health is, like I said, is getting a lot better. And
all right, well, let's ask Rebecca that. Rebecca, in some cases, does it enhance one's ability? Karen would write music. Now she writes a lot of good music. Does it enhance that?
Yes, it does. Because it ET contact is consciousness, and the brain is part of consciousness, and those neural pathways are connected. One of the things that is happening to the humans as a species, and Karen, I love your story. That's a very, very profound story, what you've been through, and thank you, is that humans are developing a more balanced brain where you're not overactive on the right side or the left side. And when you talk about ET literature, contactees talk about the fact that ETs often have a unified brain. And maybe this is something that we need as a space-faring civilization. And technology can get us there. And Karen's neural pathways were enhanced with this experience.
Let's go to Oregon City, Oregon. Brian, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm not sure what the experience was, and I've been building up the nerve to call in for a while now when you have different people on with this topic. I was maybe 4, 5, and around 6 years old when it first started. in the middle of the night, I would be woken up, and I had very, very myopic vision. Without my glasses, everything was really blurry. And all I could really see was a blurry globe-looking thing. I wasn't sure if it was a light that they were carrying or if it was them. They wanted me to go with them. I was terrified to paralyze. I was completely paralyzed with fear. I did not want to go with them. I don't remember going with them, but there was always a sensation of more than one surrounding me and wanting me to go with them. And it stuck with me all these years because when I was around 8 and 9, they would visit my little sister and I would complain. My parents would always say it was just a nightmare until the one night my mom woke up and a globe of some sort floated out of my bedroom. She saw it from her room. She saw it and froze, and she talked about it the next day. So I don't know what it is or was.
Rebecca, any cases like this?
Oh, absolutely. Hi, Brian. Thanks Hi. For sharing your story. This is a family phenomenon, and not all members of families are conscious of the phenomenon. You look at that whole Betty Andreas story where
sure.
she talked about, you know, she was quite aware. The one daughter, Becky, I believe, was quite aware. And the rest of the family was rather switched off about it. And it also, I believe, and I'm becoming more and more convinced that it also flows in bloodlines genetically. in terms of the whole paranormal ability, the psychic ability, telepathic ability. Brian, does this run in your family at all?
Well, my dad's had quite a few incidences where he's had a dream about something and the dreams come true. I've had a few of those. They get more vague and further between. When I was a kid, they were really clear. I mean, I remember as a, I was about 12, I guess, when I had a dream that a space shuttle was flying over really low and all of it was crying, "It's crashing, it's crashing." And this was before the first one exploded, but I think it was a dream of the one that broke up reentering.
Yes.
Now, but, you know, there was a few things like that throughout history in my life.
Precognitive ability.
Yeah.
That's a strong precognitive ability.
Does this happen a lot in a dream state, Rebecca? And then we'll take a few more calls.
Well, I think it definitely, in terms of our consciousness and how we culturally deal with it. Of course, I mean, dreams are something that we can write off and be a little bit more relaxed about. I mean, Brian said he was paralyzed with fear. Some of that fear comes from our culture's inability to accept the paranormal as normal, and that's why your radio show is such a gift to our culture, because you are paving the way for culture to say this is okay. That's where exoconsciousness moves out of psychopathology.
Are more and more people who claim to have been in contact coming forward, or do they still keep this to themselves?
I think people come forward continually now, just because of the internet, because of Hollywood. Hollywood is a direct access to forming our cultural opinion. I mean, the thinking today of that beautiful film Knowing, where the children were the ones in the innocent experience, they were the ones that went to the next extraterrestrial-like reality.
Rebecca, next hour I've got James von Prague. He's a medium, speaks to the other side. How do we know that some of these contact cases aren't dealing with spirits and ghosts? Or, as I'll ask Jim, how do we know that he's not dealing with ET contact? How do we know?
Do you want to ask Jim that or me?
Oh, I'm asking you. Jim's not here yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. sorry. I would say that it's interesting that you asked that question, because I do a lot of medium work, actually. And I do a lot of work that, and I write about it in the book, I deal with people who have passed over. And that's a very different experience than dealing with ETs.
All right, next up, let's go to Linda in Alameda, California. Hello, Linda, your turn.
How do you do? Thank you very much, George, for taking my call.
Of course.
And Dr. Rebecca, I'm going to share a story of experiences that I would have between ages 4 and 7. The unique thing about it, in my case, I'm blind from birth. And so, of course, at that time, I wouldn't have had any concept of UFOs or ETs. Interest in space because of the old Colonel Bleep cartoons, but beyond that, no real knowledge. And I would be awakened in the middle of the night, and I would see lights. I never have had any concept of color, but the lights would sometimes start out like about the size of a dime on my pillow, and then they'd get bigger and smaller, and they'd change shapes as if they were playing with me. Then they would, you know, I'd ask questions, and, you know, I'd ask what cars and trucks look like and things like that.
Lovely.
And so I never knew whether these kinds of things were more spiritual, angelic, or whether they were some sort of contact from, you know, interplanetary sources or interdimensional sources. But I just was friendly with them and just went along with them, kind of. And once the lights would start coming, I would be fully awake, and I would not, you know, have moved from my bed. You know, I would just, it was apparently some kind of interdimensional thing, but I never could quantify it.
Linda, was there any sound connected to them?
No.
They were totally silent.
Totally silent.
Is that unusual, Rebecca?
My experience with orbs has been, and that's what it sounds like Linda's experience, it sounds like to me, was that they had a high frequency pitch to them oftentimes. Not always, but
right.
sometimes. But that definitely sounds like you were having an orb experience. And such an interesting case, Linda, because being blind from birth, did you have a concept of light?
I had, at that time, light perception in the right eye.
Okay.
No sense of color, but I could definitely see light.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
But it was definitely something that I could see out of both eyes at the time when I was seeing these, whatever they were, interdimensional lights or whatever.
So your optic nerve was somehow being stimulated by these lights. It
right.
Like.
Right.
You could see out of both eyes.
My causation of blindness is retinal detachment. So apparently they were stimulating the vision somehow, but in both eyes.
I will predict to your radio audience that soon, if not already, are we coming to understand exactly what Linda's talking about in terms of what technology is telling us about the brain.
Sure.
Just the capacity of the brain and how consciousness is in the brain and beyond the brain. And that whole David Chalmers is a philosopher in Australia, mm-hmm. talks about the easy consciousness problem and the hard. And we can solve easy consciousness problems like categorization, discrimination, like Linda and the lights, but we can't solve the hard consciousness problem. What's it feel to be like Linda?
Tell me about astronaut Edgar Mitchell's Quantrac. What is this organization?
Quantrac is, of course, Edgar founded IONS, and now he's also involved in Quantrac. Quantrac is a nonprofit group, primarily physicists, and a few, myself and Terry Mansfield. Terry's involved in peace. I'm involved in exoconsciousness, so we're doing the peace exoconsciousness representation within Quantrac. They are working with developing a prototype of a free energy, a zero-point energy automobile, rocket, and airplane.
Very good. Well, you know, Edgar's pushing scientists now to get involved in this because he believes there's a real science behind it. And that's important.
And bringing in extraterrestrial information at the same time to enhance that scientific knowledge, which is, he's such a pioneer.
Yes, he's one of a kind. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, we need about 10,000 more like him. Rebecca, where do you get the book, Exoconsciousness?
You can get it from my website, and if your listeners are interested, they can go to my website, exoconsciousness.com, and in the download section, they can download Chapter 11 free and also order the book there or at amazon.com. And thanks so much for just helping your radio audience learn about all of the dimensions of consciousness and the extraterrestrial origins of who we are and where we're going.
Well, you know, it's huge, Rebecca. I mean, the phones don't stop ringing for people who have these stories or questions for you. And I got to believe there's even more out there.
Oh, there is so much more. We get to be the ones, like Edgar talks about, his forebears crossed the plains in the wagons. That's what we're doing in this field right now, George. You, myself, Linda, Karen, Brian, who called in, we are of the wagon train generation in this consciousness and extraterrestrial knowledge. And we are uncovering the first bits of information, and it's just going to accelerate. Barbara Handclaus says that from 2009 to 2012, we are going through an immense acceleration of knowledge. And we see it happening now. These are just the first stages.
Good job, Rebecca. Dr. Rebecca Hardcastle, her work, Exoconsciousness. Up next, James Van Praagh, Unfinished Business, What the Dead Can Teach Us About Life.